he was called, in particular, a liberal after this incident, which is a really, really negative term in Indonesia for Muslims. And he lost friends and he lost family member support. So he found this to be a really difficult thing to go through.
Hello, you are tuned into the Peace Frequency, a podcast series tapping into the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible and finding ways to create a world without violence. Welcome, I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and today we are broadcasting from our studio at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C. My guest for today's episode is USIP Peace Scholar Carrie Ann Carter Person. Carrie is a Carnegie pre-doctoral fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation and a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science at Stanford University. Her research focuses on the impact of violent extremism on political behavior in the Islamic world. Her dissertation is titled The Moderate's Dilemma, Asymmetric Costs and the Case of Islamist Extremism in Indonesia. So Carrie, thanks for sitting down with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today because your dissertation takes a look at one of the bigger mysteries, at least for me, around why violent extremist groups have been able to thrive, they've been able to spread, expand, and control entire areas, at least to the extent that they have. And I'm thinking in particular about ISIS, of course. They've been in the news and they've lost a little bit of ground recently, but over the past, you know, over half a decade, they really expanded. And so the mystery for me is that these are groups that represent such a small minority of the population when it comes to folks who are willing to commit acts, extreme acts of violence. And so why haven't the majority of people been able to quell or push back on these groups in their infancy stages? Before the violence escalates, grows, expands, et cetera. So we're going to get into all of that for sure. But before we begin, we start all of our episodes with a question that will give our listeners some insights into who you are, what inspires you, and learn something about you that we wouldn't necessarily get from one of the bios that we find of you online. So our behind the bio question for you is, I understand you enjoy traveling. I learned about that from you online. So my question takes us in that direction. If you could travel across any continent, what continent would you pick? And what form of transportation would you use? Walking, running, cycling, motorcycle, train, car, RV, hot air balloon, airplane, and others. So I pose that question to you.
So, Darren, I think that right now, on the spot, I would say Asia, because that's where my research is, and I really enjoy Asia, and it's huge, so I have that benefit that I would get to see a lot of diverse places. But I'd love to travel more in India, which was actually the first place that I ever went abroad. And, of course, Southeast Asia has a special place in my heart, because that's where my research is focused. And, in particular, I love going around by motorbike there, although as I get older, I realize how dangerous that actually is. But, yeah, I think I would definitely go with Asia.
And so you said India was the first place that you studied abroad or you lived abroad. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I grew up in a really small homogeneous town in Massachusetts, and my father was an international consultant and he worked in India for 2 years. And so at age 11, I left North America for the first time and went to India at the end of his 2-year project. And it was a really kind of life-changing trip for me to be 11, never really having been out of a small town, never really having seen that much, and to go all the way to Mumbai and see something that was so strikingly different.
And what do you remember most from that trip?
Unfortunately, I remember the poverty the most, and that was something that was just really striking to me. And I remember, I mean, thinking it was a very beautiful, very different, and interesting country, I got to see it from a different angle, given that my father had spent so much time there. We were staying with friends, guided by friends, and so it was a really unique experience, but I just remember being really struck by the poverty, and in particular the inequality, because there's also great wealth there as well.
So why did your dad decide to bring you on that trip?
So he had been working there for 2 years, and I think everybody was like, well, where's your family? You should bring your family out. And as a consultant, he had lots of miles, so it kind of just worked out. So we were able to just take 2 weeks off of school, and he thought it would be a really good experience for us to kind of see something drastically different from our upbringing.
That's great. And then you said motorbike. So tell me a little bit about that. Do you ride motorbikes, scooters, motorcycles?
So after college, I spent a year in Indonesia on a Fulbright. And even though I don't think you're supposed to on a Fulbright ride a motorbike, it turns out that many places in the world where you can actually be a Fulbright, you definitely need to get around by motorbike. And so I set out to learn how, and I'm not the best of drivers. So I tried to learn on kind of a more traditional motorcycle, and that just wasn't working. So I kind of traded down to more of a scooter, an automatic scooter, and ended up buying one in Indonesia and having that to travel around on. And I just loved it. I loved the freedom. I loved how much fun it was to jump on the motorbike in the morning and jet into town. But as I said, I've kind of come to realize that that's probably not the safest mode of transportation.
Yes. That's like the preferred mode of transportation in Indonesia, is it not? In Jakarta,
definitely.
At least?
Yeah, I think in all of Southeast Asia.
So for our listeners who are not familiar with the USIP Peace Scholar Program, can you explain to them what that program is and how you got connected to it?
Yeah, sure. So the Peace Scholar Program is something I've admired from afar for years, it's 10 months of support for your dissertation or fieldwork, I believe. And more importantly to me, it's also a way of kind of keeping one foot in the policy world while you pursue your kind of academic work. And so it's been a great opportunity to kind of get introductions to other people working on your topic of interest through kind of from more of a practitioner perspective, but then also those that are working on it in the academic world that you might not have exposure to in kind of the at just your specific university. It's basically a year-long fellowship and includes coming to D.C. and meeting the other people in your cohort. And I believe there are 14 Peace Scholars in my cohort. And that's also great because it connects you to people doing interesting work who are also motivated by making a difference and keeping one foot in the policy world and kind of seeing their academic work actually, hopefully, influence policy outcomes.
Awesome. And I was looking at your CV, and you've been like a fellow, or I don't even know the language, but there's different, my understanding is that there's many institutions, organizations, agencies that want to support research that PhD candidates are looking at. So you've got a long list of organizations that you've been affiliated with. Could you tell us a little bit about some of those and how you go about pursuing those and getting those opportunities? Because I'm sure there are some of our listeners who are interested in getting their PhD and are seeking opportunities to have this type of experience or just get some type of support, financial, professional, to aid them in their research.
Yeah, definitely. So as probably everybody knows, going into a PhD, it's not exactly a money-making venture. So it's really important to kind of seek out funding, not just for yourself, but also for your research, because the reality is if you want to do good research, you need to make sure you can spend time in the field. You might need support for research methodologies that can be quite expensive, like surveys or field experiments. I've been really lucky and grateful to benefit from various organizations that are kind of have research synergies with mine. USIP is, of course, one, and then I've had a relationship with the National Consortium for Research on Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, which is also in the area. It's over in Baltimore. It's known as colloquially as START, and they've been really supportive. And then also through various foundations that are just, you know, really from interested people trying to support work, like the Horowitz Foundation for Social Policy, which is really just interested in any project that is informing really big policies on questions that are important to social change. I've also really benefited from programs at Stanford, like the Freeman Spogli Institute's Center for International Security and Cooperation, which has a pre-doc and postdoctoral fellowship that's open to anybody, actually, in the world, not just Americans. And they're really interested in this work. And I think that while the funding's been really great, I think one of the biggest benefits is actually the ability to get your work out there, get feedback from a really diverse group of people that's beyond your university and beyond, a lot of times, beyond your discipline, because a lot of times when you're doing a PhD, you recognize that we're a little bit recreating the wheel within each discipline. And so I think it's these policy organizations tend to be better at bringing together people from diverse disciplines, diverse backgrounds, diverse areas of the world, which helps you to kind of inform your own research and really maximize on your findings.
Okay. Well, I want to circle back around to that in a minute and hear how some of those connections fellowships have impacted your research, but let's just dive right into the research before we do that. So the title of your dissertation is The Moderates' Dilemma, Asymmetric Costs, and the Case of Islamist Extremism in Indonesia. So I want to dive into your research by going through the words in the topic itself, in the title itself. So first, what is a moderate, and what do you consider a moderate?
Yeah, so I think this is actually the motivation for the project in the first place, is that we have so much research on who the quote-unquote radicals, extremists are and what they support, and that research is really mixed, but we always kind of treat the rest of society as an audience or inactive, and I don't think that's the case, and I think in particular right now when we have a policy agenda that's focusing on countering violent extremism, which is specifically engaging the rest of the population, it's important to kind of think about who they are. And so I have a whole chapter in my dissertation looking at this, but I found from kind of extensive interviews of elites and kind of average individuals in Indonesia that moderate is, you know, often a Western term that's been imposed kind of on the Islamic world, but now is being projected by many organizations to really mean that those that are tolerant of, in this case, when we're talking about Islamist extremism, tolerant of other religions, but also just of other ethnic groups, of other types of people, and then also that are practice nonviolence, that really focus on achieving goals either through the political system or through community action, not through the threat or use of violence. And so those are the two main dimensions by which I define moderate. I think it's a really difficult term, and it's certainly more nuanced than that, but that's kind of a starting point that I'm throwing out there.
Okay, yeah, interesting. So, yeah, let's look at some of the nuance a little bit on that one. So, individuals who are tolerant of different religious groups or ethnicities or what have you, are there cases where someone with that mindset is radical?
Yeah, so actually in the case of Indonesia, there is a subset of the population, or actually a particular group that the media has sometimes called moderate militants, which I actually talk about in my work as well. And they are a group called Bansar, and they are a youth militia associated with the largest, actually, Islamic organization in the world, Nahdlatul Ulama. And they believe in using force to kind of promote toleration and counter Wahhabism. So that's really kind of counterintuitive. But we might think about this actually being the case in the United States with some movements as well. So for example, in my neck of the woods, in the Bay Area, we've seen people use their physical presence to block far-right speakers from speaking at Berkeley. Or in the Black Lives Matter movement, we've seen people block highways to kind of get their point across. So Like these groups, these individuals in Indonesia don't carry weapons, but they do use their physical presence, kind of taking protest maybe to the next level to achieve their goals, whether that be blocking Wahhabi preachers from entering a mosque, or whether that be kind of showing up at a pesantren, which is a religious school, and saying, we don't like the fact that you are teaching violence or Wahhabism, and therefore we think you should leave the community. And so there is this small subset of the population, the moderate militants, who I think really ideologically are committed to their cause and are willing to use physical force. I don't think it's to the same degree at all that a radical would be willing to. Although we can also think of cases, when, for example, Greenpeace activists have used violence to try to achieve what they might call is a kind of noble moral goal. So you can kind of see that playing out in various movements in the world.
How did you, given the nuance or the need to explain what a moderate is and provide the context of it being kind of a Western term, were there other terms that you thought of using in this title, and why did you, at the end, decide to go with moderate?
Yeah, so Indonesia is really interesting because there's a lot of really amazing anthropology work that has tried to create typologies of Muslims, most famously Geertz, and he has three types of Muslims, two of which have kind of persisted till today, which is Abangan and Santri, which describes Abangan being kind of a more localized version of Islam, still accepting kind of the local traditions, where Santri, in its pure definition, just means that you're like religiously educated at a pasantra in a religious school. By thinking about that as maybe the more pious, religious, or is it often associated with, not that he necessarily meant this, often associated with the more pious religious Muslims. And so coming into Indonesia, that was the terminology that was really relevant. But over the last decade, it's really shifted, and I think this is true throughout the Islamic world, to this idea of moderate. And you see this in Indonesia with the current president often saying, you know, reaffirming our moderate Islam, or Vice President Pence recently in Indonesia saying, you know, oh, Indonesia has moderate Islam. And so while there's a debate where that word comes from, it's definitely been internalized, certainly in the case of Indonesia, and now being projected. And so that was the word that I think people mobilizing behind and using to kind of, in particular, to mobilize against extremism, violence perpetrated in the name of Islam specifically.
And so moderates are not also necessarily the majority, or are they? Is that how you're viewing them, in at least in the scope of your dissertation?
Yeah, so I think it's, I'm thinking of moderates, as I mentioned, as tolerant and nonviolent. And in the case of Indonesia, I also think about, you can imagine a group of people that are quite intolerant but nonviolent. And so we have those people in the U.S., for example. And so I think moderates are one of the largest segments of the population, and they sometimes can be the majority. They can sometimes be around equal to the intolerance or even less. But they are always, in what I find, certainly a larger group than the extremists, the violent, intolerant group.
Right, right. Okay, so moderate's dilemma. So what's the dilemma that you see and that you're looking at?
Yeah, so a lot of research has asked, you know, kind of this question of, from the flip side, is asked how terrorists can be so effective, or how small radical minorities can be so effective. And that research suggests that they can eliminate or intimidate moderates, and they actually mean kill moderates. And so in ISIS territory, it might be really difficult, for example, to say, I am against ISIS, because that might mean certain death. But in a lot of the Islamic world, we know these groups don't have the ability to, or the capabilities to target moderates. And in Indonesia, that's certainly the case. And so the dilemma I saw playing out there was not risk death or a speak out or risk death, but the dilemma was risk social sanctioning. And so the dilemma that I see is that moderates and the vast majority, if we're just talking about nonviolence of the population, really doesn't believe violence is right. And they kind of know that intuitively or through their religious practice or for whatever reason. But they recognize also that if they voice this opinion, that they are opening themselves up to shaming from this extremist minority. And unfortunately, that shaming has become even more prevalent as the use of social media has allowed these extremists to kind of expand their influence. And so we see this playing out in like various cases in Indonesia. And you can imagine that being called an infidel, which is a non-believer, insufficiently pious Muslim, could be really damaging, not just to your reputation and stance in the community, but to your marriage prospects, to your ability to get a good job or maintain a good job, or, you know, these various things that have real tangible costs for you, particularly in a environment of economic scarcity and low development.
Mm-hmm. So like shaming somebody on social media, if a moderate speaks out or is critical of an extremist ideology or group, and then that group shames the moderate in some form or another, and let's say in this case social media, is that shaming considered a form of violence? Or when you use the word violence and you write about it in your dissertation, is it referred to, are you referencing physical direct violence?
Yeah, so I'm referencing physical direct violence. And I think that so far when we've thought about this, we've really thought about it from that angle. But if we think about this social shaming as kind of on a spectrum where violence is like the most extreme, social shaming is actually much more common than violence, and can have kind of a similar impact on silencing moderates. And so I think it's an important thing to consider when we construct policies to try to mobilize moderates.
So what are some specific examples of social shaming that you've seen in Indonesia in this, given this context?
Yeah, so I actually talked to a bunch of people that were involved with the publishing of a book in 2009, and this is a group of individuals associated with a kind of interfaith institute in Solo, Indonesia, in Central Java. And they were publishing a book that was promoting tolerance and pluralism. And a very, very small group of individuals in the town found out about this book and thought that it was inappropriate. And so they did various things. They approached the police and said that this was blasphemous for various reasons. And they also put pressure on the institute to fire the individuals. And while those individuals were able to keep their jobs, they did have to bear the expense of hiring lawyers to deal with the blasphemy claims. Their center has been rendered somewhat dormant because they've been unable to kind of attract funding since then. And they were actually, post this incident, engaged in a dialogue which ended up resulting in kind of toning down the book and making the book a little bit more... a little bit less proactive in promoting tolerance and pluralism. And so this is a case where individuals associated with this really were impacted in their career and also in the goal of putting out this book. They weren't able to put out kind of the message that they wanted to put out. And I spoke, as I mentioned, with two of the authors in particular, and one of them, you know, he just feels like he now can't talk about his religious identity at all. He was called, in particular, a liberal, which is a really, really negative term in Indonesia for Muslims. And he was he's pinned as a liberal after this incident, and he lost friends and he lost family and family member support. So he found this to be a really difficult thing to go through. And when I asked if he would ever mobilize in the future, even though he still is at this institution, he pointed out that, one, the institution can't get funding, but even if they could, he said that he wouldn't do it alone. He would only do it if his colleagues joined him, which I think really highlights this coordination dilemma that moderates are facing, that given they're the majority, if they all work together and come together collectively, then yeah, we should expect some really great outcomes. But the problem is that it's very, very difficult to be that first mover for fear of shaming.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, why can't, or maybe it does, that dilemma work in the opposite direction?
Right.
So, you know, we could say that your title could be the extremist dilemma. And so are there strategies that you've seen or observed where a moderate part of the population can create a dilemma for those who are adopting or wanting to adopt an extremist ideology or set of actions, that they go through some type of social shaming that discourages them from doing that? Have you seen it work in the opposite direction?
Yeah, so I think that it can work in the opposite direction, and that's when the coordination dilemma has been solved. And so in places where people coordinate, like this group I mentioned, Bansar, who is referred to as moderate militants, they've been able to stop kind of Wahhabi preaching in certain areas. The problem, I think, is that that's really difficult to achieve that coordination because there are asymmetric costs to mobilization between extremists and moderates. And so my dissertation, I explore the fact that given the extremists are a smaller group, that means inherently it's easier to mobilize. And we have a large collective action literature that says, you know, small groups, single issue focus, much easier to mobilize. But the other challenge is that social shaming is often tied to religious practice. So we can think about excommunication in the Catholic Church. We can also, in the Islamic world, think about Takfiri ideology. And Takfiri ideology is the idea of expelling non-believers or insufficiently pious Muslims by labeling them infidels or kafir. And this has traditionally been monopolized by the right and by extremists in the Islamic world and has been really central, for example, to the Islamic State strategy of shaming the opposition as being insufficiently willing to kind of defend Islam or insufficiently willing to fight for the caliphate. And so this monopoly by the extremists makes it really difficult for moderates to kind of take that ground back and say, no, you are the insufficiently Muslim ones, the ones who use violence on behalf of religion. That doesn't call for that. And there have been attempts with rhetoric to do this in Indonesia. Most notably, right around September 11th, a group was established in Indonesia that was called the Liberal Islamic Network. And they tried to kind of say, you know, this is not Islam, and like, let's talk about what Islam is in a modern sense. And very, very slowly over time, this is actually why liberal is such a bad word in Indonesia. The kind of conservative right was able to basically chip away at this and say that they were the bad Muslims, that liberal is this awful word. And this culminated in the the MUI, which is a semi-autonomous religious body of the government, actually issuing a fatwa saying that liberalism was dangerous, which is kind of so the moderates really did, I think, try to take the upper hand and say, you know, Islam doesn't have to be like this. It doesn't have to be associated with violence. What does it mean in our current era? Like, how can we talk about Islam? And they were undermined, basically, and the extremists were just so effective at saying that that was a bad word, and now effectively changing that into a social sanction on its own. So no one wants to be associated with being liberal anymore. And so while it's possible, it's really difficult to kind of overcome these asymmetric costs. And I think that the best we can do is hope for coordination and encourage this coordination. And then you wouldn't have the moderates dilemma because you'd be know you were part of, you know, the majority all acting together and collectively condemning this.
So some of the asymmetric costs that I'm hearing you talk about when it comes to the moderates are they're labeled an infidel, and that can have implications on their job, their social network, their family, marriage, things like that. So pretty much on all angles, if they get labeled or attacked with that word, it can have ramifications in all these sectors of their life. And then some of the costs for the extremists are what?
Yeah, so I want to clarify on the costs for the moderates. These are real and imagined.
Okay.
So you can imagine that you see, like this, for example, the story I told about this book in 2009, that this, you know, it got a lot of media attention. And recently there's been a lot of these cases, high-profile cases, where the shaming gets media attention. And so it might be that the likelihood of you facing those costs in your community is next to zero or even zero, but you might not want to risk it if you're really sensitive to these costs. And the costs for extremists, so yeah, there are definitely costs, and this is probabilistic, so there, I'm not saying that every extremist would not be susceptible to shaming. But because they're such a small group and because they do have a kind of flow of resources coming in from external sources, they're less susceptible. Like, they don't need to, for example, have a day-to-day job, right? Because they can actually get funding, which makes being an extremist a job. And so there's, you know, so maybe they're less susceptible to these. They also have really tight networks, and they tend to be very concentrated. And so you might be less concerned about marriage prospects, whereas moderates are a huge, diverse, diffuse group who are also kind of split along a variety of other things, which also makes it hard for them to come together. So there are definitely costs to extremists, But if we think about the most extreme version of an extremist, they're willing to give up their life to for their cause. So they're definitely less concerned, maybe inherently because they're so extreme, they might be less concerned about these social costs.
Mm-hmm. And I also assume that getting, for example, these individuals that had written this book and they had gotten attacked as a result of it, if they had gotten external funding from another, from outside of the country, and particular from a non-Muslim country, that would have made it even worse, I would assume.
Yeah, and I think that something that's been really interesting is that I was doing a lot of this research during the Obama administration, and the kind of feeling, and I don't have direct evidence of this, but the feeling from people that are trying to mobilize in Indonesia was that the funding coming through for these kind of works needed to steer clear of funding these kind of like ideological debates or funding these things that were kind of pushing this agenda for exactly that reason, that they didn't want to come across as, you know, this is just a Western kind of speaker that's totally illegitimate. But that also has the alternative outcome of people that end up being controversial or being kind of shamed almost then have harder time getting funding because they look like they're doing something controversial. So it's kind of interesting how that policy can have kind of two dual outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, let's continue with the title of your dissertation. So we talked about what a moderate is, what the dilemma is. We talked a bit about what some of the asymmetric costs are. And so you talk about asymmetric costs and the case of Islamist extremism in Indonesia. So for you, how are you defining extremism in your dissertation? And I think, you know more than anybody, this is such an important conversation. I mean, here at USIP. So the first part of this question is, what constitutes extremism in your case, in this dissertation?
Yeah, so I'm thinking about extremism as those that are pro-violent, intolerant. And I recognize that this is definitely a controversial term, and there are several nuances. And I try to get it more into that in my qualitative work on this. But I think it's really difficult, and I think you bring up the even more difficult situation as its association with Islam. And I don't think about it. I think about violent extremism as an issue that we encounter all over the world. I use the case of Indonesia, because that's the case I know well, and the extremism that they are grappling with currently is kind of religiously motivated or associated extremism. But yeah, I think that actually my dissertation can speak to extremism that's nonviolent, and I also think it can speak to other extremism, violent extremism. So one case that's come up a lot when I present is Sikh extremism in India as applying as well to that.
Mm. So nonviolent extremism, what's an example of nonviolent extremism?
So we might think of somebody who, so if we think about like the American kind of context, we might think of moderate as completely different than what I've just described. We might think of moderate as somebody who's in the middle of the road politically, and you have the left and the right, and then you have kind of the extreme groups within the left and the extreme groups within the right. And I think that those groups, they're not using violence, but they certainly are using shaming to try to influence the moderates. And I think in an increasingly polarized political environment, it's harder and harder to be a moderate. And we see that, I think, in the U.S. case, where we might think that groups that are associated with the far right have been able to say, you're not sufficiently conservative to people in the Republican Party. And that has real-world impacts for their fundraising abilities in the next election cycle. So that's an example kind of nonviolent extremism. I don't want to associate extremism the way I'm talking about it with violent extremism with any given party, but I think that there are versions that, if we were just think about a more extreme policy stance, where this happens.
And so why Indonesia? You talked about this a little bit earlier. You said it's the largest Muslim majority
democracy yeah.
in the world.
Largest Muslim majority country.
And largest Muslim majority country in the world. So I assume that had partly to do with why you chose Indonesia as a place where you were going to study this. Are there any other reasons why Indonesia spoke to you?
I think it's a really interesting place to explore this because when we do think about kind of Islam and moderation, Indonesia is often kind of put forward as the example of moderate Islam, as the example of Islam and democracy working. And I remember years ago it used to be Indonesia and Turkey, and then for a hot second Egypt, and then, you know, now there's a debate about Tunisia. And Indonesia has kind of still been like been able to sustain kind of a very tolerant, nonviolent, democratic existence, which is great. But at the same time, we've also seen over the past couple of years this increasing kind of influence of this extremist minority. And so it's a really interesting case to explore this, that why in one of these places where we really do think the moderates are empowered and are in power politically, we can still see the extremists exerting a lot of control. And some alarmists have actually kind of said, you know, Indonesia's on the road to more of a, well, people have said the Talibanization of Indonesia. People have called it the creeping Islamization. That's going to bring it in line with other parts of the world. And they're saying this very pejoratively, so I don't endorse that. But I do think that there is a real threat there of going down a more conservative road. And so the question is why and how in one of these cases where we really do see this long legacy of toleration, how the extremists can be successful at this.
Mm. So it's probably one reason why all these foundations and institutions are interested in or supporting your research for this very kind of fear, potentially. Yeah, I mean, so that's kind of coming full circle is, what are you hearing from foundations and organizations that have supported your work around why they're so interested in this?
Yeah, so I think people have a variety of motivations, whether that's certain organizations that have either flagged this part of the world as important to them, so as being a really large, obviously large country. Also, Indonesian extremists have kind of certainly traveled to Syria, but they've also been integral in the current conflict in the Philippines, and so understanding if there's the threat of that. Why foundations find this work interesting? I think it's interesting because I think it's a question that we really just have no research on. We really just have no understanding of how to implement these policies and how to effectively kind of empower this large segment of the population, the majority of the population. And so that's been a struggle academically because it's hard to situate myself in the literature because there isn't much. And CVE on its own is a very new kind of concept. But I think that one of my advisors would say, when you can kind of do research that's really motivated by real-world issues that are really coming from kind of the political questions that are out there, that's when you can attract a lot of interest. And personally, that's, I think, when it can be intellectually fulfilling because you know that you can actually really inform or hope to inform kind of the development of these policies as they play out. So for me, that's what kind of drove me into political science in the first place was these real-world issues and why were they happening and how could they be addressed. And so that's really guided my research and kept me very close to the policy world, which I think is really attractive to funders and foundations because it's something they can relate to. Whereas, you know, other people are doing really amazing work, but the work maybe isn't as closely related to kind of current issues.
Right, right. So I want to hear a little bit more about how you have immersed yourself in Indonesian culture. So I'm going to phrase the question this way. What aspects of Indonesian culture have revealed something new about yourself?
That's a great question. So I think the thing that I learned the most about during my time and living in Indonesia was that as an American, we can be, Americans can be very, very, for lack of a better word, uptight. And so I think in Indonesia, I really came to kind of embrace the idea of, well, they call it rubber time, but being a little bit more relaxed about the schedule, kind of stopping to smell the roses. if you want to think of it that way, and really kind of enjoying life. And so that's something that I try to remind myself of when I'm having, you know, a crazy week here, or when I'm really stressed about certain things. And it's like, it's all going to get done. It's all going to come together. And, you know, it's going to be fine. And there's no reason to stress about it. And I think that's something that I really took away from my experience in Indonesia.
No, that's nice. I mean, you know, something that you saw in Indonesian culture that you then embraced and has now kind of changed you in a little bit in terms of how you think about time or what have you. No, that's great. Now, also, I'd love to hear about language. And if you're conducting research in Indonesia, particularly with various populations, moderates, extremists, you've got to speak the language. So you do speak Bahasa. I think you have intermediate level Bahasa is what I read on your CV.
Conversational.
How did you go about learning Bahasa?
So when you asked me why Indonesia before, I didn't tell you. My selfish little reason was, like, I'm awful at languages, and Indonesian happens to be one of the easiest languages to learn. So that was also a motivating factor when I went there after college, because I recognized how important it is to really work at the language, to kind of understand the culture and to make relationships. And so I was like, oh, this is great that it's so easy. Yeah, I focused a lot on learning the language, and I remember when I first got there, I just had this, like, really tiny book, and every time I heard a new word, I would have whoever I was speaking to write it down and then write down the definition, and just had, like, lists, like, pages and pages and pages of words, and would kind of read them here and there when I was on public transportation or going from point A to point B, just to kind of remember them. But yeah, I think learning the language is a really, really crucial part. I think it's an important part of travel in general, but particularly when you're trying to do research in an area. I'm lucky in the sense that Indonesians actually speak, a lot of Indonesians speak English very well, and particularly elites speak English very well and often want to practice their English. So I've started interviews in Indonesian where it's so clear that they want to, you know, revert to English. And that's fine too. I'm happy to be kind of someone they can practice with. But yeah, it's been, simultaneously, a challenge and kind of a exciting portion of my research.
I will take a break. And when we come back, a couple questions on, like, your process. Observational data, how you go about doing that, risk. I think my assumption is that working on issues around violent extremism, that you're putting yourself in potential contact with folks who, you know, could be threatening. I want to jump a little bit into your process. I want to, like, see how you do this work. So you're looking at moderates, you're looking at extremists, you're looking at the costs that they face, and you're gathering survey data and observational data. And I want to jump into the observational data. I do not have a research background. I'm not in a PhD program. So I'm fascinated about how you go about gathering all this information, these stories, these perspectives. So you get off the airplane and you go to the home that you're staying or the hotel or what have you. How do you start this process of getting observational data on this topic?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, Indonesians in general are just so nice, and it's such a great and welcoming culture. And so, I think I was really lucky in how this played out, but I started just with, like, a few contacts through, I had one advisor who had spent some time in Indonesia, and so he gave me a few contacts. I kind of reached out to some people that I knew that were kind of big elites in this field, and I just, you know, kept at it and kind of asked people for interviews. And in Indonesia, which I think is true in a lot of field work in the developing world, you really, it was interesting because I had this like desire to, I'm going to Indonesia in 2 weeks and I'm going to set up, you know, all my interviews for the next like 2 months. And like, that doesn't happen. So it's actually more of a like, hey, are you available tomorrow? I can meet you wherever. And so I think I got to Indonesia on my first trip with one interview scheduled. And so I was really intimidated. But it just, you know, it's a snowball effect. And that's why they call it snowball sampling when you interview. And so I would talk to somebody and, you know, make an effort to not just treat them as, you know, a respondent, but also as somebody who's really interested in their work. And also I've gotten to know a lot of my kind of respondents as friends at this point. And they've been really great at opening up their cell phones and giving me other contacts. And one resource is that's really great is also other academics or American researchers out there in the field, because they're really sympathetic to what you're going through. And they know a lot of people. And so as much as we can all pay it forward to each other and share contacts is really helpful too. So I just started by doing that, asking, kind of going through an interview process, asking everybody I talked to who else they thought I should talk to, or could I learn more about whatever movement they were working on through talking to their colleagues. And so that's kind of how I ended up building out my interviews. And then I also conducted homestays in Indonesia. And that actually came through going through these interviews. People would invite you to conferences on these topics that you're studying. And I would just talk to as many people as I could. And I actually just kind of got to know a lot of people in Nahdlatul Ulama, which is the largest Islamic organization I mentioned earlier in the world. And they were just super helpful. And, and I think my third fieldwork trip, I was like, I'd really like to just stay with some people and really see like where these movements are getting off the ground, where these CVE policies are being successful. And people opened their homes to me. It was incredible. So, you know, I got to spend almost a week with a rice farmer in in Batang in central Java. And the insight you get from being there day in, day out, watching as they kind of actually try to implement these policies on the ground, talking to them about how they deal with people in their community that have kind of joined these more extremist movements, it was just fascinating and really eye-opening. And I used that to then inform kind of my strategy for finding other observational data, like empirical observational data. And that also helped me figure out who to ask, where to go, and then what kind of data to collect for myself. Because you kind of see these stories playing out, and then you're like, how can I think about this more systematically? And the kind of empirics follow from the insight you gain from these conversations and field work.
What's the radio in that situation? Another way to phrase it is, what are the messages that these individuals who are joining extremist groups or becoming more radicalized, what's the media that they're consuming that is impacting the decisions that they're making to then join these extremist groups?
Yeah, so I think in Indonesia, it often, I think it comes through various avenues. One would be social media. One would be that there are really institutionalized networks of extremists that date back to movements that are actually even before or kind of born in colonialism. And these networks are still around. Another that I saw a lot was people going off to college and being kind of vulnerable and alone in a new place and being attracted to certain groups on college campuses. And then the last one that I think is becoming increasingly important is just the kind of Wahhabi sympathizers being able to preach in increasingly broad populations, and to show up. And in Indonesia, they often call them the Saudi alum. And so they're not actually Saudi Arabians, but they maybe went to school in Saudi Arabia or the Middle East and have come back and teach ideas that either are explicitly pro-violent, particularly against quote-unquote deviant sects like Shia or Ahmadiyya, or are not quite pro-violent but are quite conservative, that kind of sometimes can open the door, I think, for individuals to explore even more conservative or violent ideologies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when you are having conversations with individuals, I mean, what do you have with you? Pen and paper? Do you have an audio recorder? And where are these happening? In cafes, in people's homes, in an office building, in a park, anywhere that they're willing to talk with you? Paint that picture for us a little bit.
Yeah, so I like to think of from when I step off the plane in Indonesia till when I get back on the plane that I'm collecting data the whole time. And so when I'm in the Uber in Jakarta and I have a two-hour ride because traffic in Jakarta is outrageous, why not have a conversation with the Uber driver? And usually, and like 99% of the time, people are really interested because they're like, well, why are you here? Like, who are you? Like, why are you interested in our country? And so you can really have interesting conversations. So I take advantage of kind of those informal situations.
Well, what do you say to the Uber driver if the Uber driver says, oh, what are you doing here? What are you studying? What do you say?
Yeah, so I usually say I'm a researcher, and I usually start off like pretty vague, and I say I do like Islam and politics, and they kind of, and then usually that leads them almost to a reverse interview where they ask me questions, but I can kind of gather their thinking.
Okay.
And I with kind of these informal conversations, I find it most useful to focus on just political events. I mean, there's always something going on that's related to anyone's research topic, and so it's, you know, easy for me to engage with, like, oh, well, what did you think about, you know, the recent election or like gubernatorial election here in Jakarta? And then that can kind of get into a conversation where they're, like, talking to me about kind of their thoughts on this broader research agenda that I'm interested in. With the more formal interviews, I often use WhatsApp. It's a really valuable tool in a lot of the world these days to arrange them, and then I'll meet them wherever is convenient for them, whether that's their office, a coffee shop. Mall culture is really huge in Indonesia. So a lot of times in malls, particularly in Jakarta, I found that when you leave Jakarta, and particularly when you're in more sensitive areas, that's not necessarily an appropriate place to be because people don't want to be kind of associated. That might actually be, they might be nervous about being associated with talking about that kind of.
Like a mall might not be an appropriate place.
So when I was in Solo, spending time in Solo, I had an experience where the very first interview I had set up there was through a contact in Jakarta, and he asked to meet at the mall, which I thought was completely normal. So we met at the mall, and we sat down at the food court, and we started talking, and we kind of exchanged pleasantries. And as I started to get into my more structured interview questions, he stopped me abruptly and was like, "We can't talk here." And so I hopped on his motorbike, and we went to a small restaurant on the outskirts of town, and he asked to be seated in the back, and we sat in the back. And we had a completely open conversation about his own research on radical groups in the area and then also his work with interfaith dialogues in the area. But I noticed that when the table next to us got, like, seated, the volume of his voice seemed to completely, like, correlate with if there were people around us. And he ended up being a really, really nice guy, and so he actually invited me to stay at his house, and we spent, like, the next 4 days together going from interview to interview. And I just watched as how he would be willing to speak about kind of his opposition to these extremist groups, the use of violence in front of certain people, but not in other places. And, you know, when I asked him why we had changed from the mall to the restaurant, he kind of said, you know, I'm not scared. I don't think I'm going to get hurt, but I don't want to offend anybody. And so this was actually a really informative experience for me because I watched in real time over several days as he anticipated exactly the likelihood or probability that he would be in the presence of somebody who kind of disagreed with him or had extremist sympathies and therefore, you know, wouldn't want to speak out. And I actually used that experience as one of the motivating experiences to design a survey experiment to kind of test that on a broader population. So where I did conducted interviews really varied according to the respondent and their preferences.
I'm gonna be real. My heart rate goes up when I hear you telling the story, and the realness comes to the fact that you are a woman. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're by yourself, doing this research, throughout the country. And there are risks that come with that. And so I'm interested to hear how you protect yourself, how you tune your awareness to your own safety, and how you've learned to do that along the way. Because I think it is different, you being a woman versus if you were a man. I think the risks would be different in many ways. So can you tell me a little bit about how you do that?
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it's not, I mean, it is certainly not a, it's not a light matter. It's a huge issue when anybody does field work, I think, in a new place. And I have been asked to do interviews in hotel rooms and clearly said no. And so, you know, I think it's just an instinct, an individual kind of feeling and assessing each interview differently. But definitely when I've been meeting with people that you might consider as more extremist or in these, particularly in the groups that are vigilante groups in Indonesia, I always bring somebody. So it's really important to not show up alone. So and to the extent I can, I always try to make sure it's a public place. Some people really prefer you to go to their house, in which case I definitely try to bring somebody if it's not somebody I know well through the network, through my own network. But one thing is that I've been lucky to be in the field several times and to really build out a network. And so I do have a good sense of who I can trust, like who I can be alone with and who I can't. Whenever I go to a new place, I make the effort to arrange someone to go with. The solo case is really interesting because I had actually made arrangements to have kind of somebody come around with me, and they pulled out last minute for exactly kind of the reasons that this other man I described was unwilling to talk about things. I got a long WhatsApp text being like, I don't know that I want to be associated with this. I'm so scared. And, you know, I respect that. Okay. And I just got very lucky that this first respondent, the first person I met in solo, was like, I'm going to take you everywhere and go everywhere with you. And he came through a very trusted person. And I remember when he invited me to stay at his house, he was like, why don't you stay at my house? It'll be safer. And I remember my husband being like, are you serious? You're going to go stay at a stranger's house? And I will say Indonesia is very unique in that it's extremely safe. But also I knew he came through a trusted, you know, source. I had met his family. I knew that he was actually an imam at a mosque next to his house, and I knew his whole I had met his congregation at that point. So it seemed like a very safe situation, and in fact it was. But yeah, I think it's a little bit of kind of having certain rules about when you decide to bring a third person with you or to an interview, and also kind of feeling out each individual case and gauging how you know this contact, where they came from, and how much you can kind of trust that network.
I'm also hearing a lot about trust. What have you learned about effective ways to build trust with people when you're asking them questions about sensitive topics?
Definitely. Kind of building a rapport with them is really, really important. And so I did that several ways. One was just checking in with some respondents over and over again. Some was really letting them get to know me before getting to certain questions. And a lot of the time it was also really, really making it clear up front that like they could be anonymous, and anything that I said, wrote down or recorded, could be completely anonymous. And then it was up to them to determine if they would want to be identified in any of my research. And I think that's a really strong signal at the beginning, because if you stress that to somebody, I think they're generally going to believe you, particularly when I kind of start with, well, I used to live here, and I love Indonesia, and here's why, and I'm really interested in this, and not really treating it as a clinical kind of research question, but more as like I'm really curious about this, and I know that you know a lot about this, and I would love to hear more about it. I think goes a long way.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Well, we're coming to the end of our conversation. I've got two more questions for you. One, it sounds like you interviewed a lot of folks that would be considered or identified as moderates. Did you interview people that would be considered extremists? How were those interviews different, if at all?
Yeah, so the vast majority of my interviews were with moderates, since that's kind of the focus of the research. But I thought it was really important just to get a perspective on some of these groups. And so I did talk to leaders with Hizb ut-Tahrir Indonesia, which does not preach violence, but is kind of considered on the more extreme end, and was actually just banned by the government recently. I also talked to people at the Islamic Defenders Front, which is a vigilante group that sometimes kind of certainly uses violence in various, they call them sweeps, where they kind of will use violence to pursue their moral agenda. And then I also talked to former leader of Al-Qaeda, for example, in Indonesia, and some other people that are associated with the more local kind of terrorist groups. And those interviews were strikingly different for obvious reasons. I had an hour-long conversation with one individual about why 9/11 was fake. And so you can imagine that a lot of those interviews, so my interviews with moderates really focused on what is a moderate, like, how do you see yourself, like, what are the obstacles to mobilization, and what are your personal experiences? And when I talked to these other individuals kind of on the other side of the spectrum, it was much more focused on much more of what is the current state in Indonesia, and how do you perceive of this kind of struggle, this ideological struggle, and what are your goals as an organization? So it was much more specific to that, and often it digressed into kind of a rationalization of why, sometimes not directly saying why violence was justified, but why violence was certainly just a defense in this global war of Islam versus the West. And so whether that was talking about why 9/11 was fake, or another interview digressed into Hillary Clinton's had written a book that had come out a little bit before one of my fieldwork trips, when I had had a lot of these conversations with these individuals. And she had talked about in this book how she thought U.S. policy had created the kind of situation through which ISIS could rise. And so that had been kind of jumped on by this group in Indonesia to say, Hillary Clinton admitted that ISIS is from the U.S. and that the U.S. is the only, like, is what makes ISIS look bad, because the U.S. is, like, the puppeteer of ISIS. And so it was one of these interesting things to watch people flip-flop, because it was, like, if ISIS was perpetrating, like, these awful, awful things, then that was because the U.S. was doing it. But if they were, like, defending and the caliphate and, like, making this, you know, amazing place in the Middle East for everyone to go to, then, you know, they were fighting the righteous fight. So it was, like, anything bad that you could kind of ask them about was, you know, somebody else's fault. So it was a really different type of interview. It was more just kind of interesting for me to get a perspective on how they spun their own kind of ideological feelings and kind of played into this debate.
So there's something, obviously, that's appealing to some people about that extremist perspective, angle, message, whether it's attacking the United States or some other country for being responsible for X, Y, and Z, or duty that someone has to a religious ideology or what have you. It works in some cases on a lot of people. And even if it doesn't work on the majority of people, the way that I interpret it is that it works, and it's powerful because it can have somebody fundamentally shift the trajectory of their life to join an extremist group. Sometimes they have to leave their family, leave the country, be willing to commit acts that, a year ago they never necessarily would have thought they could do. Sometimes you may not agree, obviously, with the person, but they're talking to you, whether maybe it's in their manner or their certitude or the way in which they're weaving together a story, where you're kind of like, that's interesting. I'm saying, do you understand the appeal to an extremist ideology?
Yeah, I think I definitely do, because we're all a function of what we know, right? We're all a function of the information we have at hand. And so if you only have certain information at hand, or you're being inundated with certain information, or you're not getting access to kind of this counter narrative, then I can completely understand why you would think that one way is the right way to go. And I think that's actually gets back to, like, the core of my dissertation, which is what makes it so hard for moderates to kind of sometimes speak up, is because it is, I mean, we can see today, it is really debated what it means to be a good Muslim, what it means to defend Islam, is there this global war going on between Islam and the West? And that rhetoric is certainly out there. And, you know, it's really hard, I think, to completely ignore it. And it's really easy to fear being labeled the person who, you know, is with the West or the person who is anti, you know, anti-Islam because you're not willing to, quote unquote, defend Islam. And then what does that word defend mean? That's, you know, a really, we have no idea. Like, does that mean going out and sacrificing your life? Does that mean through political means? Do we even need to, you know, is there something to defend here? These are all things that are completely up for debate, that I think are really causing, like, a lot of confusion, and there's also a lot of disinformation at the same time. And so these things, I can completely understand how people are confused about how to kind of, you know, proceed with this identity that they may be, being their religious identity, something that might mean a lot to them, and then they're being told, well, you know, it only means a lot to you if you're willing to do X, Y, and Z. And so I can understand how that would be a really difficult narrative to counter if you don't have information to do so.
And then kind of last question on the interviewing an extremist, do you have to present yourself, introduce yourself differently when you interview extremists versus when you interview moderates?
I try to give everybody the same information. Okay. You know, I'm working on a research project on X. I'm from this university. And I think sometimes for the same reasons, like, I might be much more sympathetic, for example, to the moderate cause, but I try not to let on either side, because I want to hear what people have to say, and I don't want to let my own biases or my own feelings influence what their answers are to my questions. So I try to treat all interview subjects as similar as possible, and all answers as maybe much as I agree with them or as egregious as I find them, I try to just take that as data points and not kind of influence or let my own personal feelings influence the conversation.
That's a gift. That's a real gift. And I want to thank you for kind of sharing us what your process has been and what you've learned along the way and the challenges that you faced. And it's just really fascinating. And what I find really valuable is that, you know, research to those who don't make a living doing it, I think most of us recognize the importance of it and what it generates in terms of helping us address issues or understand issues, at least answer questions, unanswered questions. But it's helpful to hear what the work actually looks like, in this case, in the field. Carrie Ann Carter Person, thank you so much for being our guest today. Your work is fascinating, and it's certainly timely. You have been listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series tapping into the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible and finding ways to create a world without violence. The Peace Frequency is produced by the Global Campus, USIP's online learning platform designed to teach and learn critical peacebuilding skills. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Our theme music for today's episode is composed by B.O. Crew. You can check out their free music at ccmixter.org. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon, and I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Be sure to check the Peace Frequency website to access a recording of this show and other archived episodes of the podcast. The URL is thepeacefrequency.com. You can also subscribe to the Peace Frequency on iTunes and Stitcher. Until next time, keep learning, supporting, and building peace.